Hello and welcome to the Deep Track Podcast, an exploration of watches, trends, and culture with a few adventures along the way. I'm your host, Blake Bettner. This week, I'm happy to welcome my friend Zachary Pena to the podcast. Zach is a longtime friend, an amazing, accomplished photographer in the watch industry. He also does nature photography, really beautiful photography. I will leave links to where you can find his photography on his website, on his Instagram, down below in the show notes. Zach was also at Watches and Wonders this year, so we talk about some of the new releases, some of our favorite things. We talk a little bit about Bremont. He gets some hot takes out. So we talk about some of the watches in his own collection. He has an amazing collection of watches, and he's not afraid to wear watches that he likes that that maybe break the convention in terms of like sizing standards or anything like that for wrist size. And I really appreciate that about him. And he puts all of his watches to pretty good use as well. So we talk about some of these things, as well as his kit or loadout or gear loadout, whatever you would call it, for shows like Watches and Wonders. So we get into all of that stuff and a little bit more in this episode. A reminder that you can find all of our coverage of Watches and Wonders at the DeepTrack.com. And also, we have a handful of videos that have gone up now covering some of the watches that we were able to get hands on with at the show. We will have the first review to come from the show is coming later this week, and it is of the new Tudor Black Bay 41, the monochrome black and white watch, which I'm just wrapping up right now. So keep an eye out for that and get subscribed over on the YouTube channel if you are not yet. All right, with that out of the way, let's jump into this week's episode with Zach Pena. Zach Pena, welcome to the Deep Track Podcast. It's good to see you. How are you? Thanks for joining me.
Oh my God, Blake, it's so good to see you. I saw you as I saw a lot of folks at Watches and Wonders, which was like, it was a 15-second flyby. Hey, what's up? Great to see you. Off to my next meeting. So I figured I'd catch up with you at some point.
It's tough. It's and that's kind of how it is like that whole week, right? It's especially if you've been around this game or industry for a long time. It's impossible to like walk between any two places and not be like, you know, like, true. Oh, say hi. But by the end of the week, if you see people, you just kind of do the like nod, be like, oh, hey,
yeah,
what's up?
And, yeah.
You know, and you're both like going, and it's just how it is.
And no one's bummed that you couldn't sit down and have a coffee with them, you know. I feel for guys like James and Jason, you know, they spend 4 hours late to every meeting. I was late to most meetings, but not probably on the level that they were. But it was great to see you.
I know. Yeah, you too. I'm glad that we caught each other just briefly there in the hallway.
Yeah.
And I know that you and I have been talking about getting on the podcast, so I appreciate you making some time for
me. Oh, absolutely.
You are you're very prolific. You do a lot of different things. you're an excellent photographer. You've done a lot of work in the watch industry, in and around the watch industry. Maybe for people who aren't familiar, give us a little intro. Who are you? What are you up to these days?
Oh, thank you. Gosh, that's really nice of you to say. I it's so weird to say like I'm a photographer because I feel like I still every day I'm trying to learn something new. And so you feel like, I don't know, I that's one of the things I enjoy about photography in general is that you never really feel like you've figured it out. And I know I've spoken with guys that are, you know, in their 50s and 60s and they've been doing it for many, many years and they still feel like they haven't figured it out. But yeah. I think on paper, yeah, a photographer works. I do a ton of content marketing. Marketing is kind of my background. And I've been sort of in and around the watch space for the better part of the last 5 or 10 years or so.
Yeah.
Initially sort of as an enthusiast and like a forum denizen.
Then
the forum stuff kind of begat other things and here we are. Yeah.
You have one of my like low-key favorite watch collections.
Oh gosh.
you got some killer watches in the collection.
Those are fighting words. I've seen what you have. Those are fighting words for sure.
What are you wearing today though? I like the strap that I'm seeing in the video. What is this? What's on your wrist?
This is I'm wearing the Blancpain 50 Fathoms. This is the Bathyscaphe in grade 23 titanium. This is kind of a weird watch because it has kind of a gray, they call it like meteor gray dial, but like the TIE 23 references have this cool vertical brushing, but the chronograph does not. And the chronograph just kind of looks like a slightly grayer version of the steel version. So I don't really know why this watch exists, but I love it in steel. I love it in titanium. I love kind of most all things titanium. And this is actually an OEM Blancpain camo NATO strap.
No kidding.
So they very quietly did three camouflage colors in 23 millimeters. It's very difficult to find NATO straps in 23 millimeters for any
23
of the Blancpain
millimeters.
watches.
Oh my God.
And
Yeah.
so it's similar to the Tudor one. It's that kind of jacquard woven, you know, the pattern is sort of woven in there instead of dyed, so
Yeah.
it looks cool. And
Love it.
yeah, respect.
Certain.
I mean, respect to any brand doing OEM camo.
Yes, or OEM
This
Velcro
juncture,
or something
yeah,
that's like
OEM Velcro,
unexpected, and it's kind of
exactly,
like, what makes you go like that? I know this
100%.
IWC has some weird like kind of foresty camo type straps as well that not many people have seen. Like they're
Oh,
out
I've seen
there.
them. I've almost bought an IWC just so I could have. It's the Mr. Destructo or something. It's some streetwear collab thing that they did.
And it's awesome. It looks
Those are
great.
so sick.
I tell you, like all these brands
Yeah.
do these like quick release strap options on their cases, but I want to see more creativity with the straps that they sell to their customers. If you get somebody that's there buying, eight, 10, 15, $20,000 on a watch, and if you give them, half a dozen different custom strap options, they'll probably buy every single one of them.
I completely agree. I completely agree. And I think even for like the for the niche people who spend time in the industry and have sort of, you know, we change straps a lot. I think maybe most folks who want a date aperture on their watch don't really change straps very often because they don't know they can. And when presented with the option, suddenly it's like, oh, it's on.
When they
Game
need a
on.
date, all they need is a date. All they need is
Right.
the date. I like
Right,
that.
exactly.
Well, I'm wearing a Tudor Plagos FXD in the black dial,
Yes.
which of course is a great. It encourages you to change straps, since you can only do the pass through this stuff. So every day you get
I
to have
wish they
something
were
different
still
on there.
doing the camo NATO for that. That the camo for that would be amazing.
A camo for this would be great, especially in there, because the Velcro strap that they put on this, I think, is great. More flavors. I just want
Totally
more
agree.
flavors of it.
Totally agree.
And
What color is the strap on there? Because there's a green one too, isn't there?
it's
A
like
green one exists for
this
that.
one. So this is from Crown and
Oh yeah.
Crown
Okay,
and
okay, okay.
Buckle. It's
Oh
a matte
yeah.
supreme NATO in like
The
that kind of grayish, I think they call it. It's like gray beige. It's a mixture. I
those are
don't know.
very good. Those are the only non oh, so CNBs, NATOs, and then Artem straps. Those are the only two kind of non OEM straps that I wear at this point. And everything else to try to get OEM if whenever possible. But I don't know, you just gotta settle into the stuff that you like and
Exactly. And I've got a lot of their matte Supremes. I really love the texture that they do here. I'm not I've no affiliation with them, by the way. I talk about them on a lot of podcasts. I tell a lot of people about them. So if those guys are listening, shout out for the great work that you do. I also have the new Tudor Black Bay 41 monochrome
Yes.
here that I've been reviewing, so I'm going to shoot a video with this this week, and it'll be up later this week. I'm just wrapping up the copy for it right now. So I've got all my like black and white dial divers out, the
Love that.
Submariner, the 39, this FXD, and then this thing, and kind of putting them all, like contemplating them all together.
I love that. I was like very underwhelmed by that watch when I saw it, and I think that just sort of speaks to how the show goes, where like you see something that's actually quite significant and you're like, yeah, whatever, it's monochrome, like, and then you shoot the thing that you know that people are kind of there to see. But once it kind of marinated and I started to see more images from around the show, and then I got home and started to kind of skim through coverage and stuff, like that is actually quite a significant watch in the framing of what Rolex used to be versus what Tudor is now. Like that's a hugely significant watch, but it was very quietly like, yeah, it's just a black and white version of something that exists already. Like next.
It's true, and it feels like a watch that should exist, that should have already existed.
Yeah,
And I think it was the
exactly.
same with Tudor, like maybe the last couple of years, where all the releases drop that first day, and you kind of scroll through Instagram. You might scroll past them, not realizing they're new watches, but you have to kind of look a little bit closer, and then they become like, oh, okay. You start to see the significance. This one in particular, I think a lot of people associate the Black Bay range, especially non-complicated dateless Black Bays, with gilt treatment of some sort, right? Because I think only like the chronograph collection, maybe some precious metal cases, and then the blue bezel, I guess. But all the other ones have gilt. Like there is no just black on black on with white there. And as you mentioned, alluded to that, this is kind of like flies a little close to the Submariner, and that's why I got all these watches out to kind of contemplate it in in that kind of context, which I think is interesting, and it feels like kind of a maybe a turning point for the Black Bay collection as a whole. And it's interesting to contrast this with the release of the Black Bay 58 GMT, which, you know, I've always been kind of like maybe a little bit on the fence about like the gilt and that would like kind of old looking new watches, but this year is probably the most I've ever heard people complaining about it. Like I feel it's maybe like maybe turning a corner in terms of, okay, are people kind of over, like I know plenty of people like it, but it used to be kind of a few people like, I wish they would do get away get away from the gilt and all that kind of stuff. So where do you fall on this?
Yeah, I have a feeling about gilt. I like, look, if you complain about gilt, you're not allowed to like you have to throw your jeans out after the jeans don't look new anymore. Not allowed to buy like suede leather or anything. I just feel like it's an aesthetic, and like, you know, I have a pair of Trickers Chelsea boots that I absolutely love. They came in this kind of like tumbled suede sort of leather. They're black and tan, and it's not that they are pre-distressed. They're not like pre-ripped jeans. It's just the aesthetic of the leather. So I feel like there's a very big difference between pre-ripped jeans, which is like a faux aged case or faux age dial, which has been done. I think Laco did the most like egregious version of the faux aged. So that's like the pre-ripped jeans, I would say. But then there are tasteful fades, there's tumbled leather, there are all of these interesting other aesthetics that you can bring into like menswear and fashion and apparel or what have you. And to me, gilt is just an extension of that. It's an aesthetic. So like I've been like a ecru loom, as Panerai calls it, stan for many, many years. Like they just do black and tan. They do tan loom. It's not faux anything. It's just tan.
It's a
like,
design choice.
Faux. It's a design choice. 100%. Faux is that Laco example where they like they stonewash the case. And they like, I mean, there's like the loom is like broken out of the hand. I mean, it's art. It's art what they did.
Yeah.
But that to me is faux. And I just, So I'm team gilt for sure. I think I think it's a super cool aesthetic. There's like there's a very metallic, very subtle metallic flake in the paint that they use for the gilt, written on the dial and in the markers and stuff. And that's obviously something that would not have been the result of aging, and I just think it looks sick. I think it looks so sick.
So that's interesting, and I've been telling people too that are maybe on the fence or less enthusiastic about the gilt and how it's used on the 58 GMT, and that all the pictures, like the environment that they have it there in the booth, is maybe not as flattering as it otherwise could be, right? Like if you took it outside and stuff like that, and I've since seen some like really natural kind of light looking photos come out with it, and I think it looks way less kind of egregious. But in general, just like the amount of people that I heard kind of complaining about that kind of made me feel like maybe it's turned a corner here.
Yeah.
And, you know, it will be kind of more like the gilt. It's an aesthetic choice, but like for the future of these collections, they have to start building it on something else, and the whole Black Bay identity can't be based on that anymore. If a whole new generation of collectors are coming into it saying, you know, I want something that's more like neutral, modern, you know, and of course the Black Bay is kind of based on like an amalgamation of historic Tudor designs, right? So I think it works just fine in black and white. Like the design still works just as well, but maybe it's lacking a little bit of that personality that people know and definitely maybe love or maybe hate about the Black Bay.
It definitely lacks any sort of divisive qualities that people could. I mean, you know, at this point, it's a Submariner with Tudor on the badge, and so the thing that you would complain about is that it's boring, like Submariner.
Yes, which, exactly.
You know, which is good. I mean, it's good. I will say that it has a bezel, and Tudor did do the Black Bay 36, three, four years ago?
Yes.
Monochrome.
Yes.
Correct. Yeah. Without a bezel. So it's that. But
that's a good shout out to that watch.
Like, to a watch that no one bought. Yeah, for sure.
It's, you know, and it's surely, like, now that this exists, I'm sure that we'll see more iterations of like the 58 GMT in something like this. Right. I think it would work really well. You know, and then maybe just the Black Bay 58 uncomplicated would be great. I'm really excited about that GMT movement though that they put in the 58.
I know.
And I really hope that we see like a titanium Black Bay Pro with that movement in it.
I kind of thought we were going to see a Black Bay Pro in Tai this year. I don't really bandwagon the the predictions, because I just think if we've learned anything from Switzerland, it's that they love to make sure that like their ideas are their ideas and they're not following sort of the rumor mill or speculation. Yeah. So we're always invariably going to be disappointed. But I was sort of in the back of my mind thinking it had been 2 years or 3 years since the Pro was introduced.
Yeah.
And I was like, it's about time for a new color or a new metal, because most brands kind of do every other, but we didn't get it. But yeah, I agreed. It was a new movement there, which was exciting. So that was very cool to see. I'm kind of waiting for the Black Bay to get, like, I love the green that they do in the gold versions, and I really wish they would bring that to non-precious metal, but
interesting.
I don't love the idea of a full gold Tudor bracelet or not. As much fun as that watch was, I love that dial.
Such a perfect, kind of olive. A titanium Black Bay with.
Yeah, I mean, if I was just, you know, if I had my own box of crayons, that's what I would do for sure.
Yeah, I love it. Well, as you mentioned, I think it is kind of that default, you know, boring diver. Yep. I think the Submariner does it perfectly well. That exists. We don't need any others. Now this exists in like at half the price. You know, it bums me out when I see like kind of new micro brands kind of coming out with these exact same things. You know, like let's see, maybe let's get some creativity going on here. Let's get some, you know, the basics and stuff. Those are covered. People do those well. Yep. Like, you know, show me what you got. Something is back.
I agree.
And you work with some pretty interesting smaller brands, micro brands, I guess you'd call them. And the new Benthos is something else that I wanted to ask you about, because I have not seen this in person yet. So I know when the first one came out, people kind of bemoaned that it didn't have the chronograph, but now they, of course, kind of brought it out the right way. Have you had a chance to go hands-on with this watch? From Aquastar, by the way.
No, Aquastar. So, funnily, you should mention that mine is actually en route. I haven't seen it or photographed it or handled it yet, I have to admit. But I did shoot the non-chronograph version. It's such a cool case.
Yeah.
And we have to remember that like the founder of Deepstar, this gentleman named Frederick Robert, he was highly involved in many Omega designs, including like the Flightmaster and some of those kind of crazy, like super deep cushion cases. So I feel like the Aquastar, the Benthos in particular, with that like very dramatic, like tonneau shaped case, really scratches the like modern Omega sort of that era of Omega in such a cool way. And there were a few Seamasters of that era too that had these like crazy cushion cases. So he went on to do work for them as well. So anyway, quite neat to sort of get that vintage aesthetic in like in a much more sort of modernized case design. I really wish I've used it so far. I have not. But you know, respect to any chronograph manufacturer that advertises with the pushers work underwater. You know, I dive. I know you dive. I don't need to actuate the chronograph at like 50 meters underwater. But like, you know, if you're using it, you activate it. You do your giant stride. You're in the water on the surface, kind of bobbing there, waiting for the crew or whatever. You start the chronograph like that. That to me is when you would do it. But you know, with a watch where you couldn't do that, you're still pushing water into the case, you know, with these kind of pump pushers. So the Bathyscaphe is a watch that advertises pushers that work underwater, which I think is quite cool. If any of this is all just kind of like silly bragging rights, like I'll take as many things that I can brag about as possible.
Of course.
Aquastar does it. Blancpain does it. I think Zin does it.
It was like pump style pushers too.
Correct. Yeah. The pump style is impressive too. Yeah. But I guess, you know, at the end,
I have a screw down pusher. Because Omega has the screw down. I want to make sure I get this information right. I feel like on some of the older Seamasters they had screw down pushers, but they did advertise them as them working underwater, and maybe the Planet Ocean as well. But maybe it's a collar, and it's not a screw down,
like
it's
a rubber like a collar bushing type thing situation.
I think it's a collar situation. Anyway,
that's interesting. The whole concept of a dive chronograph watch is kind of a strange, weird thing to me, which kind of makes it fun and cool.
I feel like it makes a ton of sense, like, because you can actually time multiple events. I've seen comments on the forums of people being like, yeah, dive chronograph doesn't make any sense. I'm like, what? It makes a ton of sense. It makes more sense if you can actually use it in and around the water, obviously.
Yeah.
So, I don't think it makes sense if you can't start it in the water.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You just have to get the right brand.
Yeah. Like, I suppose, like, an easy M1 or something like that, like along those
Yeah,
lines.
exactly.
I like
Yeah,
conceptually something
exactly.
like that, I think makes a lot of sense.
Totally agree.
So, you was there anything else from Watches and Wonders that like really stood out to you as like as impressive or something that you kind of made a mental note of that like you want to come back to or would like to spend some more time, especially now that like a couple weeks have passed? Is there something that you maybe overlooked that is still kind of like lingering in the back of your head?
I mean, I, like most folks, have my own sort of like Bremont hot takes. Everybody was talking about Bremont. Product wise, I feel like, I always look for tool watches at these shows. We always kind of look for cool engineered stuff. Singer had, they're insane. The Dive Track, going back to, it's a dive chronograph. Use a $90,000 dive chronograph.
Hey, why not,
it is
man?
worth, yeah, why not? A center. I mean, it's interesting because it's a center mounted chronograph. So again, like the chronograph hand, similar to the Zen, like you were just talking about. There's very few center mounted chronographs where the instead of putting the chronograph information on these tiny little subdials, it's the center, sort of main
All off the
chronograph
hand stack,
hand. Correct. Yeah. So the AquaStar does as well, center mounted, which is quite cool. And
And it
again, like,
only
you know, it,
totalizes up to the minutes as a result,
that's correct. That's
obviously.
right.
So,
Correct. That's exactly right. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's, again, dive chronographs make sense, not writ large, because most of them don't. But again, with certain sort of design elements in there, I think they make a ton of sense. So that was fun to see and shoot. Chopik had some amazing dials that were really fun to see and shoot. One of my favorite watches of the show was that like Hunter Green Chopard LUC. Micro rotor. I mean, it was a dress watch. It was a dress watch. There were some very nice dress watches at the show.
There were, there
That was
really
my
were,
favorite. Yeah. I mean, I think that really reflects sort of the times, I would say, just, as brands are kind of trying to chill out a little bit. I really did like the Chopard. Yeah, but yeah,
like,
Bremont, I guess that was most of the digestion I think I've had to do after the fact was like around the feedback. I mean, I've never seen that brand has had a rough go for 20 years. They've just had people crying and complaining to them constantly. Like their fans are the most toxic fans of any brand or band or organization or anything that I've literally ever seen or heard
So
in
where do
anything.
you fall on the changes that they've made? So they, of course, kind of like from the roots, kind of ripped up and started over on the brand. My take is that like, I
Yeah, what's
thought
your
even
take?
if it wasn't for me personally, like I will admit I liked the triptych case. I thought it was pretty cool,
Yeah, I
and I
agree.
liked some of the executions of the Martin Baker, of course. But I feel like they built up a lot of goodwill over a long time building that brand on a foundation that the.
Totally
You know,
agree.
I wouldn't blame some longtime fans from being a little like perturbed by,
Oh yeah, 100%.
well,
Yeah.
where is this? And it's kind of a total change of direction too, in going I guess slightly down market in their offerings, and the aesthetic doesn't really connect generally to what they had established over those prior 20 years. So I would understand some of the frustrations from longtime fans
No,
of the brand.
absolutely. They've just, and again, when I speak about the toxicity of their fans, I don't know. It's not everyone. The loudest voice is always like the smallest concentration of people in the room. But, let's, like, if we walk things back a little bit, from day one, they entered the market and people were like, "You're too expensive. This needs to, like, a Rolex costs this much. This needs to be in-house." So they went in-house and that got even more expensive. And people were like, "What am I supposed to do with a $10,000 Bremont?" Or, whatever that number was. It was, they were like 8K or something. And so they were like, and then they had the whole in-house thing. And then they went, and I just feel like all the developments they've been doing in the last decade was in response to the community, and it was never good enough. It was like being in that like toxic, abusive relationship where the person's like, "You need to be able to do this." And then they do that. And then they're like, "Oh, no, you have to really do it this way." And it was never going to end. And at the end of the day, the brand was not profitable. There were not enough people buying their watches for what they were doing to make any sense. And I just think that, like, when like a band goes under, they're like, "We're breaking up." It was like, And the fans like lose their mind. It's like, well, you never came to our shows. You never bought the merch.
Yeah.
You were rude to everybody about the brand. I just feel like, look, like the direction that Bremont is going in is going to take some getting used to for everybody, myself included.
Yeah.
I shot the watches. I chatted with everybody at the group. I chatted with Davide for a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like there's super smart people in the room making huge decisions for the brand that are not easy. And I just think that when something's not working, like what's the famous quote about like, it's insanity to keep doing the same thing and expect the same result.
Yeah,
like
expect different. Yeah. No, definition like, of insanity. Yeah.
Yeah. The literal definition of insanity. So I just think that like, change is hard. I'm in the camp that like, you know, it's maybe, I don't envy people that had to make the decisions that were made, but at the same time, like, I would have liked to have seen more of like the, cause I really did quite like Bremont's design aesthetic. But again, like if the aesthetic is not the aesthetic or the price point isn't appealing to enough people, something has to change. Something has to break.
Yeah.
And they, you know, I also love the Triptych case. I've owned several Supermarines over the years.
Sure.
As I understand it, the Triptych case was super cool and very distinctive, but not as practical, or as, it didn't deliver on a singular sort of functional purpose beyond the uniqueness of its aesthetics.
Yeah.
And so Davide and the incoming team's mission was like, every design choice we're making has to achieve a purpose of utility or functional or some function within the aesthetic. It can't purely just be for aesthetics.
Yeah.
So, you know, I respect that as well. And I wouldn't be surprised if Triptych or some variation comes back at a later date.
Mm-hmm.
I worry about, you know, because they didn't touch the Alt One collection, you know, so
yeah.
I'm worried that when the time comes to change or to make edits to their sort of most iconic collection, that we're going to have to go through all this again.
Yeah, but at least you know, if they can articulate that, like their vision for, you know, and make it that simple, even if you don't agree, but just like stick to it, then
I agree.
You know, more power to them.
And the Terranova is a super cool watch. It has an interesting case. It has, Bremont has never made a comfortable bracelet. And quite frankly, in 20 years of the brand, one of those years was profitable from what I heard.
They've sort
of lost money every year of that brand's existence. For them to finally make a bracelet that was like comfortable and actually quite distinctive. Because again, if you remember like the Supernova, the integrated bracelet watch that came out last year to much fanfare, like it just looked, you know, the bracelet looked kind of like a mashup. Every bracelet they've done to date has looked like something else that exists. The Terranova bracelet is not just comfortable and like beautifully finished, but it's actually like kind of quite unique. It has this cool like curvature to all of the links. They're brushed and polished.
Really? Okay.
They fit amazing. It's a butterfly clasp. And I saw like literally people will complain about anything. They're like, oh, you can't have a butterfly clasp on a field watch. And I'm like, why not? Like, just put it on NATO. Like, the price looks sick. I don't know what the problem is here.
Yeah,
I don't see the issue.
Yeah, that's funny.
So, I think the Terranova is super strong. And, you know, the rebranding, the logo and all that stuff. Like, I don't know if you saw, like, in the booth, they had that giant, like, three-dimensional logo sort of on the back wall there, which in 3D, the logo makes more sense. As a two-dimensional tiny thing printed on a dial, it looks like tons of other stuff. And no one mentioned that, like, you know, that compass is also on the crown of a Chopard Alpine Eagle. You know, like the compass thing has been done. Let's move on. I get it.
Yeah, that's so maybe the best way to think of them and what they're doing is kind of if you know, erase all knowledge of what Bremont was and kind of just think
that's
of it
hard.
As if you just discovered this brand walking into it, you know, then what would you think? And and if that was the case, I would say, you know, need some time in the oven and like,
agreed,
let's keep building on the foundation,
agreed,
which is the totally normal,
agreed,
thing. I think so.
Agreed.
And I had Bilal on the other week and we kind of both have said something of like, let's give it some time, you know, and they're maybe getting some,
exactly,
maybe some unfair treatment, but that just kind of comes with the territory when it comes to Bremont.
It does. Apparently. I know those guys have thickest skin. So again, you give things time and I've definitely like, I've definitely seen bands and brands and artists and people that I followed and things that I liked change, not for the better, but
if
it's not for you anymore, it's not for you. But it doesn't mean that, like, I don't know, you just kind of move on. But I've also, you know, there will always be like the time before and the time after.
Yeah.
And Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I think it's certainly been handled with more grace with other brands. You look at like Doxa, for example, went under a huge managerial shift
Yeah.
3 or 4 years ago, 5 years ago.
Yes, it has been. It's
And
probably three or four or five
yeah,
years ago now.
nothing, you know, up front, nothing really changed. Everything, that was one of those instances where everything behind the scenes kind of changed because the brand was already doing quite well. But yeah, I think there's two schools of thought for sure. One is change everything quietly behind the scenes, and the other is burn it all down.
Yeah, like
Start
rip
over.
the Band-Aid off and like let's just go, like let's start building on it, you know.
Exactly.
And so
Exactly.
you know, but we have more power to Davide
I
Serrato, who
know.
you know, of
I
course,
know.
speaking of these Black Bays, was there at the with Tudor when those came out in 2012. So he knows, like
Yep.
he's, you know, I mean, he
He
deserves the
knows.
benefit of the doubt, maybe
I agree.
on
Yeah,
stuff
I
like
agree.
this. So.
But I think, you know, he it takes time. The Black Bay was not an overnight sensation. And he was at Tudor for a longer tenure than he was at Montblanc, I believe. And some of these other brands. So I think, you know, with the case with Bremont, like I really hope he gives it time. And I just, you know, the community needs to give it, everybody just needs to kind of chill. And I'm rooting for them. I'm rooting for the brand. I always have been. You know, Nick and Giles are rooting for it. Mike Pearson, who's no longer with the brand, is also rooting for it. So, you know,
Good people all around. Yeah, Nick
yeah,
and Giles have
I
always
agree.
struck me as really, I don't know, positive, a positive force.
I agree.
For
I agree.
in my
Totally agree.
experience with them, so
I think they may be between you and I, and obviously not between you and I, but you know, classic case of like the CEOs, you know, also being the designers and also being the X, Y, and Z at the company. And I think maybe they should have just been the brand's hype men earlier. And I think maybe they wouldn't have burned themselves out on it. I think
that's just
that would have been
that's
helpful.
yeah.
I've definitely seen companies too where the CEOs kind of get in their own way a little bit. I don't know if that was the case with them, because I know their design language and their decisions heavily influenced everything that was kind of going on. But at the same time, like, they did need somebody to come in and say, like, wait, you've lost how much money? Wait, what? What are we doing?
Like
The English,
coalesce
the
it,
ENG 200 movements cost what? What are we
yeah.
doing here? So,
Yeah.
you know, they needed an editor at some
Yeah,
point.
that's true. That's true. So I want to talk about like when you go to the show, like do you bring, you know, like a full kit loadout gear of things to shoot with? Or what's your like kind of walking around gear look like?
Oh, that's a great question. It changes a little bit every year. Do you check a bag when you go to these shows? Have you ever?
Well, I do.
Okay.
So I like
Oh,
in the show I wear my
yeah.
backpack, and this year I brought like a DJI gimbal thing to mount my camera
Oh,
on, so
yeah.
like walking
Oh,
around
yeah.
and stuff like that. So,
Oh,
but I only
yeah.
brought one camera and like one
Okay.
lens. So,
Okay. Yeah.
a
You can
24 to
do most of the
75, that
show.
was like pretty much
Yep.
all
Perfect.
that I needed. So,
Perfect. You can do most of the show with one lens, I would say. Ever since, so I think the first like Basel, the first like show I did was with the Blog to Watch in 2018, I want to say. And I've always shot Sony bodies, so Sony bodies are relatively light and compact. In the first show that I did, I brought one lens. In the second show, I brought two lenses. I mean, I've been doing it for 5 or 6 years. I've always had one camera body and two lenses has always kind of been my. I bring an on-camera flash, and then a remote trigger so you can trigger it off. So generally, one light, one camera body, two lenses. Over the years, that's evolved a little bit. I've brought more lenses. Last year, I only brought one lens just to see if I could do it. It was nice, but like your images, it's hard for me to take. I really always want to, like, every photo I take, I want it to be a little bit different than something that I've taken before. Like, it's really hard for me just to take the same wrist shot 100 times, you know, over and over and over again. You look back at, like, and it's funny because, like, once you kind of lock in on what works with the lighting setup that you have at the shows, like, you kind of just start to take the same stuff over and over again. So this year, I kind of forced myself to bring like a couple different modifiers. I actually brought two lights this year. I've only ever always brought one light. I'm not sure I would do that again. It was kind of an experiment. Because yeah, I just yeah, I'm not sure I would do that again. But it's interesting because, you know, you see people at the show that bring that bring continuous lighting systems and tripods.
Mm-hmm.
I've never brought a tripod to the show because I don't check a bag. This is going back to going all the way back up the chain. I've never checked a bag because, you know, my goal is always to, like, generally speaking, for me, the cheapest way to get to Geneva is to, like, book a round trip itinerary to, like, London or Frankfurt, and then book a second round trip itinerary from Frankfurt to Geneva or from London to Geneva.
Interesting.
Which is what I've done. I've done many times. It's always the most affordable. And then if I save a bunch of money, I can use that to upgrade my class. And then
because
like the direct flights from San Francisco to Geneva are obscene. So anyway, so with that being the caveat, it sort of informs my kit and has always kind of informed my kit. This year I brought a 70 to 200 lens, which is like Sony's kind of, you know, it's a long zoom lens. Cause I added 2 days at the end of my itinerary to go down to Zermatt and shoot the Matterhorn and kind of just like decompress a little bit in the snow and in the mountains before I like got back on the plane and, you know, proceeded to destroy myself again.
Well, that's a good way to do it though. Like that, to have like some time to decompress and go see something beautiful.
It really helped. Yeah. I think it shortened my jet lag. Like last year, I swear I was waking up at like 4 a.m. for 2 weeks after the show. I was just so completely shattered when I got home. And only having like those 2 extra days, a little bit of extra sleep, it was just enough time to like reacclimate sort of to that time zone. Something was different this year because I got home I wouldn't say way more rested. I was still pretty cratered, but like I was able to settle back in much faster than I've ever been able to settle in at any of these shows. Bringing that extra long lens, which didn't get any use at the show until I left.
I was going to say, so how do you even use that in the hall?
No, you don't. There's no way. It sat in my hotel room and took up a whole bunch of space in my suitcase, the last 2 days. So I would do that again. But I think if I hadn't brought the 70-200, I probably could have brought like a longer macro lens, which would have been nice to... Mm-hmm. The longer macro lenses, you don't really get a ton of... The first SIHH I covered. So I covered Basel in 2018 and then I did SIHH in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought the Sony's 90mm macro for that. And like the 90 is great to have, but you're carrying around a lot of extra stuff. Like you just don't need it. And to your point, if you have a 70 to... If you have a 24 to 70... You know, like you kind of cover that. So the sweet spot for me has always been a 35 or a 50 mil.
Yeah.
You know, and then you just
take that like a wider prime.
You really have to punch. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
That's what I'm used to as well. Wide
prime, like if you want to take pictures of the homies around the show or, you know, sort of Geneva vibes. This year, I back in like February or March, right when it came out, I got the Fujifilm X100 VI.
Oh, cool.
And that's a great little... In previous years, I was bringing a Leica Q2 as sort of my sidearm, I guess, around the show. But the Q2 is just a little bit larger. And so the X100 is amazing because like it slots kind of into the extra space. And like it's amazing. I love the form factor of the X100s. You get a little more... Has a bigger sensor. And so that was a great little sidearm to have. Doesn't really add any weight to it.
Mm-hmm.
So X100 is the sidearm, and then Sony A7R5, and then Sony's 50mm was kind of my show kit.
A7R5 on a 50.
Kind of the sweet spot. Okay. Well, on a 50, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay.
That for me is the sweet spot. And last year I shot Sony's the 35mm G Master, the 1.6, 1.8 G Master, which works as a macro lens in a pinch, but you know, it's not, the 35 is not as good if you're like laying a watch down on the table and you want it. You know, Grand Seiko had that amazing dress watch, the high beat dress watch with like the Japanese wagtail as the click, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is like a little bird head hidden in the movement. And like getting a lay down shot of this tiny little component in the movement is pretty challenging with the 35. So it was nice to have the 50. That would have been an instance where the 90 would have been perfect. But
again, stuff like that.
Didn't bring it this year. So.
I took like a 100mm macro last year for an Icons, and that was like, it was, I mean, you could only get like certain shots with it, and it's such a big lens. So
exactly. Yeah,
this is the first year that I've just brought a single, like,
good for you,
like non-prime lens, and it was kind of like nice. I was like, wow, this is much easier. Yeah, I don't have to think about like where I'm at, where I'm standing, anything like that.
Yeah, I know, that's kind of the dream. And I ran into a few other guys shooting around the show who had 24-70s, and I think I actually don't own Sony's 24-70.
Oh, really? It's a great lens, especially the new one. It's like it's a smaller. Dude,
it's a smaller
form factor. It's great. I was really happy with it. I only brought one body, a ZV-E1, predominantly for video. And with that glass on it, you stick it into photo mode, you get some decent pictures too.
Done.
And it's such a small body that it's like, but it's got the same sensor that's in like the FX3. So, so the filming stuff can work well. And I like to play around with this stuff. I don't know how talented I am, but I like that, like you mentioned earlier, that there's always room to be like growing and learning new things about this and pushing yourself. And photography is just like this endless, hole of doing this always, which I love. And I'm capable of taking a nice picture here and there, but there's still so much that I see, or that I see other people that I'm so curious about that, I want to try. So I still have a long way to go, which is fun. And that excites me, right?
That's the best.
But you mentioned that it's funny, because when I was in that Grand Seiko meeting, like I thought of you when they talked about the click. So they designed the special click, and it winds beautifully. And they like had us all winded as you go down, but it's in the shape of the bird.
This is the bird head.
And
it's
you photograph birds. You're a birder. You're a birder. You've been doing that for a long time.
I have, yeah. And by the time I'm not sure when this is publishing. By the time I've fully recovered from jet lag, hopefully by the time people hear this, I will not be jet lagged anymore. But we're headed out to the Faroe Islands to go look for, it's a pretty amazing bird spot in the spring as well, because it's along one of the Atlantic flyways. And so there's tons of birds that are moving around a little bit in the spring. And so you get all these cool like Arctic seabirds and stuff out there, but you also get like all of these cool kind of migratory birds that get blown off course and stuff and land in the Faroe. So yeah, lots more bird stuff. I don't post as much bird stuff as I used to, and we still go out and do a fair bit of it. I'm just not bringing my camera as much as I used to. But I have Sony's big 200 to 600, and I shot a project for Chopard and Hodinkee last winter, and rented Sony's 600 millimeter F4, which is this sniper rifle sized monster lens to shoot bald eagles in Alaska. And that lens is just an absolute dream to shoot. I mean, for the size, I mean, it's quite lightweight for the size, but it's also still like an enormous lens. There's no getting around the fact. So that was a fun like packing mission again, to pack, a lens that size, kind of takes up its own roller basically. So that like lived in like a roller case. And then all of my other like jackets and gear were on my backpack. Still no, didn't check a bag for that. Very proud of the fact that you stay pretty mobile with all this gear. But
watch, do you always go birding and do these adventures like with a certain watch, or is it do you bring a roll of watches and wear something different every day? What's your approach there?
Chopard sent me with a watch to shoot kind of on location, which was like the blue Alpine Eagle. I didn't wear it kind of just lived in the backpack, and then just to keep it clean and stuff, I took it out and shot with it. But if I'm moving around, I tend to, most everything I own is titanium at this point. And if I'm leaving home and going to another time zone, always a GMT. It's nice to kind of stay on schedule, check in with the wife, see how everybody's going. I love the kind of, there's this sort of constant reminder of home time. It's weird. I'm always so anxious to leave, and then you leave and then you're on the plane and you're like, I can't wait to get home. So I don't know. There's something kind of reassuring about seeing home time kind of on your wrist all the time. Like, the crew is just getting up. And always GMT. GMT at the show this year, GMT at the show last year. Pretty much every shoot where I leave California, definitely try to wear a GMT.
Is there a specific reference that you prefer?
Oh, she...
is it like a GMT master, you mean, yeah, or just like in general, a no, GMT
just
watch?
In general, yeah, always a GMT. Okay. I have fortunate enough to own the Corey Richards, the Vacheron Overseas Everest, the Corey Richards edition.
Yeah.
So I wear that a fair bit in the field. I've started, so for the Alaska trip, for my 40th birthday last year, I got the Chopard, the GMT-1, the LUC GMT-1 in the black ceramized titanium. So that I kind of wore that quite a lot last year, actually. So that's what I wore to Alaska. That's also what I wore to Watches and Wonders this year. So that's actually not a, it's actually not like a traveler's GMT. It's not a true GMT, which is kind of annoying. Like when you land in a new zone, and I hear this on the, I see this on the forums a lot too, people who don't, and again, I say the forums very loosely, like I, that's sort of like a catch all for Instagram and YouTube comments and everything. but like, you know, the GMT Master is the perfect travel watch. You land in a new zone, you unscrew the crown, you click the hour hand to the correct position, you screw it back in. The 24-hour hand remains on, in your case, New York time. In my case, it would be California time. I don't have a GMT Master, but like that to me is the fund. Like that's the only reason a GMT watch should exist, is to, because they were for pilots. So the pilot lands in a new time zone, you can quickly and easily set the local time without stopping the movement and interrupting the accuracy of the watch. Like I just, you know, when a GMT watch doesn't do that, to me, it's a dual time. It's not actually a GMT. It doesn't, me, it doesn't serve the same purpose. The Chopard is not a true GMT. It's a collar style. But what's interesting about it is that the, you can't actually quick set the 24 hour hand. So most ETA based GMT watches, when the crown is in the first position, you click it one direction and it sets the date. You click it the other direction and it sets the 24 hour hand. And they only go in one direction. So if you pass their hour, you have to go all the way around, which is annoying. But when you land in your zone, you do have to stop the watch to correct the local time hands. And then you have to go back and set the GMT hand. So it's just this kind of involved process that's super annoying. The Chopard, you have to set the hands, but there's a second crown where you just adjust the ring around the bezel. So there's like an internal rotating bezel, essentially. That you just click that around to match it up with the GMT. So
that's and that's
a half
bad.
Step shorter. It's not so bad. It's a half step shorter.
Like when people like the original GMT in 1956, 65, 42, those were all the hour hand was slave to, or the GMT hand was slave to the hour hand. So it was just the rotating that bezel plus minus however many hours, and that's how it was done. And you're
that's
like it's a dual time.
It's a dual time. Exactly. I think the greatest travel watch that exists, I think, is probably like the Aquanaut, the Patek.
The
pushers.
The 5164.
Because you just, thank you. I don't know the reference number. Because you just advance or regress the hour hand, the local hour hand, and the home time stays exactly where it is. Click, click, click. You don't have to mess with the crown. I mean, that's perfect. That's as good as it gets. You don't even have to take the watch off your wrist. So to me, and I've looked, like I've as much as I love the Vacheron, it's not like the perfect travel watch, but it's a dual time, and the way that it does the AM/PM indicator is both unique and kind of fun, but like it's also not as practical.
But it
the
looks
Patek
the
is as good as it gets. It looks the business. This is
the
business.
Yeah, the 5164 that's one of my all-time favorites.
Oh, it's super good. There've been I'm completely spacing on the name now. There was a, what's the Scandinavian brand that was bought by Voutilainen? They had like the, oh gosh.
Oh,
yeah. I'm spaced on this now. Anyway, Scandinavian brand bought by Voutilainen. They are working back through like sort of a brand refresh right now. They also had an integrated stainless steel sports watch with pushers that advanced and regressed. The hour hand, similar to the Nautilus, or excuse me, similar to the Aquanaut. I think it was also like eye-wateringly expensive.
Interesting.
Gosh, I really wish I could remember the name of this brand. But there just aren't very many that have this functionality. And maybe there are others that I'm spaced on, and I have just too much tunnel vision kind of on the main ones. But That's as good as it gets as far as a travel watch goes.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a bummer they stopped making that watch in steel, but they reintroduced it in white gold this year. So
they did.
Yeah, it's a
they'll circle back. They updated something. They nerfed the water resistance. They'll circle back on steel at some point, I'm sure. Yeah.
So I heard that I saw a lot of people again on the social internet and all that kind of stuff, you know, bitching about
the forums,
the water resistance thing. But also somebody said, well, nothing changed. It's just like how they are defining those things in their testing or something, but nothing actually changed inside.
Nothing changed.
So if you were diving in your 5164, you could still go dive in your new white gold one or the 5980 or whatever, right? Like they're all going to do the same thing that they
Fine. They're all going to be fine.
And if you were doing that, more power to you out there.
I mean, exactly. I'll be the first to admit that, like, I prefer watches that have, like, the assurance of 100 meters of water resistance.
Yeah.
But, you know, that Chopard has a push-pull. It's 50 meters. I've swam with it.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, you kind of, once it gets wet, you're kind of like, okay, yeah, it's fine. I just need to move on.
Yeah, that's true.
But what do you travel with typically? What's your, do you have like a quote unquote travel watch?
The GMT Master, like the 126710,
as good as it gets.
GLRO, like it's, I know it sounds like cliche and I always feel like a little, you know, whatever people are judging, but like it's a great travel watch. And I've always had
it's
GMT.
A perfect travel watch.
For I've had a lot of the generations, and this is the one that I just, I don't know, like it's easy watch to like grab and go, and you know, for the reasons you said, to kind of adjust, make the quick adjustments as you go. It's super easy to read like on the go, so I can tell again like, oh, and my son is getting up or before school or make that call or whatever.
I love it.
You know, I know it's easy to do the math and your head and all that kind of stuff, but this is just like that glance. It's great. So that's like,
I don't want to do the math. I have a watch so that I don't have to do the math. That's the whole reason.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a Panerai 531, a PAM 531, and Panerai has tons of quote unquote GMTs, but most of them are dual timers because they run on like a 12-hour basis, and then they just give you an AM/PM indicator, which again, there's nothing inherently wrong with that.
Yeah.
There's just an extra like mathematical or like there's an extra little piece of information on the dial you have to look for. I just prefer to read things in 24 hour.
Yeah.
So the 531 is a rare 24 hour based Panerai.
Okay.
It's quite cool. Sandwich style, tan loom. It's black and tan.
This is awesome.
44 millimeters. And it's a perfect travel watch because you get 300 meters of water resistance, but you get Panerai's crown guard. So it's actually really easy to adjust, and it's a quick adjust hour hand as well.
Okay.
So you flip the lever, pop the crown out to the first position, tap, 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 adjust the hour hand, pop it back in.
And you're off.
Also has that cool sort of zero reset that the early like 9000 series calibers had. So like
you
put the crown all the way out, the zero reset. So again, it's this kind of cool, feature rich, uncommon travel watch. It's the perfect travel watch. It's a little large. 44 is a little large for like a perfect travel watch, but you know.
I don't know. You're an inspiration. You rock a lot of larger watches.
I tend to mostly wear bigger watches.
And it's not like you have a gigantic wrist or anything like that.
No, I
like
don't.
You're a small, you know, thin guy, and they all look like fine. And I tell people wearability is what you need to focus on, right?
That's true. Well, it's not even wear. I think so many watches now, the lug to lug is not as gnarly as people think it is, and it's just perception. Like it's all a head game. Like if your brain is telling you it's too big, even though like the mirror shot is telling you it's fine, or the on paper measurement. I mean, it's just you'll never get out of your own head if you're telling yourself it's too big or too small or too whatever.
Yeah,
and I just think that like, for the longest time, I was like, oh, I can't wear anything over this size. And I was like, I was leaving out or missing a lot of really fun or interesting watches by self-editing in that way. And to a certain degree, I probably saved myself a lot of money by self-editing. But on the other hand, like, I completely ignored Panerai for many, many years. And this 531, which I get so much satisfaction out of, I was just like, I can never wear that. It's 18 millimeters thick. It's 44 across. It's huge. And it's not. You put it on their big like accordion rubber strap, and it's just like it's a burly ass Panerai. It's sick. I have an Omega Seamaster Planet Ocean, the deep black. So it's like their 45 millimeter black ceramic, and I love the Hodinkee story that was written on it when Watch came out. Like the top comment was written in all caps. It says it's just and all caps, and they wrote the number out. It's they wrote out 18 millimeters thick in all caps.
Like, yeah, that's right.
But like, I mean, it is. It's true. It's 18 millimeters thick. But yeah. The lug to lug is very manageable. It's quite light because it's ceramic. Yeah. Black is naturally kind of a shrinking material. And when you get the strap to fit right, like it's the sickest watch. Also a perfect travel watch.
Same with the Pole Prof, which is like, you know, lug to lug is like
exactly
not that big. And
exactly.
You just got to like own it, be confident with it, and mm-hmm. you know, not worry mm-hmm. about it.
I completely agree. I just think there's
the experiences
more
that these
watches
offer. Yes. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, exactly. Totally. Well,
it also kind of depends on what you're doing. Like if you're, you know, I wanted it. I got the Planet Ocean, like the deep black, as kind of like a quote unquote project watch. I was shooting this big thing in Hawaii a couple of years ago, and I was like, I needed a GMT because I was going to Hawaii, and I kind of wanted something that could be like in and out of the dive boats quickly, and I could bang around and felt like a tool watch without being something that I like had to kind of worry about.
Yeah.
I wanted something black because it was a little lower key. Like it just made sense. It made perfect sense. It's like a perfect t-shirt watch. Like obviously it doesn't fit under a cuff, but like that's not the point. So I just context is important. You know, we're lucky to own multiple things that we can kind of have a thing that serves different purposes. And it's not like it's not going to be the watch you wear every day of the week, but that's not really the point. So
it's a great experience when you get to wear some of these watches.
I agree.
Right? So, yeah,
totally
I
agree.
All right, Zach, I want to be conscious of your time. I appreciate you making the time for me. Where can people go find more of you, more of your photography? And you need to make like a separate bird photography Instagram account.
I know. I know.
Because they're
really
beautiful
should.
Photos.
I really should. Thank you. It's really nice of you to say. You can find me on Instagram, Zach, ZachXryj. Zachary J, but there's an X in there. So if you just search for Zach X, you'll find it real quick. It's a lot of watches and birds and outdoor stuff. And I have thought about doing a separate birding account. But I don't know. I also really love the way that, like, you know, the Alpine Eagle was a cool juxtaposition of like watches and adventure and nature. And I do feel like there is still like a very salient crossover between these things that are built for the places that are sort of like out there, you know, and I don't know, and using them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. The bird thing has been a fun sort of side thing actually, but I really should start another account. I have so many sort of unpublished, unused bird photos that are either not edited or like, I just like having them.
They're just there somewhere, right?
They're just,
they're yours. They're yours.
Up digital space. They're mine. Yeah, exactly. And it is one of those rare opportunities where you can go out and shoot and it doesn't feel like work. I don't feel like I have to edit them, but I have the photo. That was the moment. But bird stuff is pretty fun. Let's go birding sometime.
Let's go birding. Next time we talk about that on the podcast, we could just do a birding dedicated episode.
I know.
We'll talk about
our life lists.
A lot of fun. Yeah. My wife's grandfather was quite big in the birding world. He wrote a book.
Yes.
He traveled the world.
He wrote a book.
This was his life was birding. He ran the bird part. I think there's a name for it. The bird part of the St. Louis Zoo. Like he got their birds or whatever and managed how they did all that. So,
oh my God, this is your grandfather-in-law or your grandfather?
My wife's grandfather.
Wife's grandfather. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah. So I'll dig up that book somewhere.
Put it in the show notes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'll put it in the show notes. And I'll have all the stuff that we talked about today in the show notes. Reminder, I've got kind of all of my Watches Wonders coverage on the Deep Track. I'll cordon off, so I have a link to that down below. Do you have a website? Just the Instagram?
Yeah, the website. Yeah, thanks for asking. The website is wearethepip.com. The PIP is my sort of media marketing company that I started a number of years ago, and wearethepip.com. You know, there's lots of photos that I'm very proud of that live on that site that I posted to Instagram, you know, at some point, and they look much better on the website. So if you're into looking at pretty pictures of stuff, of watches and birds and other things on the website, is definitely my preference.
Well, if you're listening to this and you have a need for a photographer or a project that needs photographing, you can reach out to Zach as well. He fits the bill. Zach, thanks so much for your time today. It's just been a huge treat to talk to you as always.
Blake, thank you so much. And I just want to say real quick, just to close with, congratulations again on Deep Track. I know this has been, it's been really fun to follow, and I wish you all the success in the future. You're doing something really cool here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. It means a lot. We can be there for each other as we grow and find new cool things to do with these watches, new adventures to find. So,
hell yeah.
All right. Thanks again. And thank you for tuning in to this episode. Everything that we talked about will be down in the show notes below. You can, if you're an angry Bremont follower, you can address your angry comments to Zach's Instagram.
Send me a DM. Yeah. I'd be happy to argue with you on the internet.
All right. Well, that's our episode for this week. Thanks so much for tuning in. Until next time, take care.